welcome to another edition of the LinuxQuestions.org podcast. First up, LQ updates. As you may have noticed over the last three or so weeks, podcasts may be a little less frequent over the summer. While we typically do a podcast every week, for the next 6 weeks or so, that just may or may not be the case, unfortunately. But after that, things should return to normal and settle down a little bit. The next LQ update, LQ will be in the .org pavilion at the San Francisco Linux World Expo. And I'm happy to announce that LQ will be in the .org pavilion once again at the upcoming Linux World Conference and Expo, which, as I mentioned, will be held in San Francisco. If you're going to be near the Moscone Center in between August 7th and 9th, do be sure to stop by .org booth number 9 and say hello. If you're interested in attending, you can use the priority code N0113 to get a free exhibit hall pass and to get 20% off a conference pass. See you in San Francisco. Now, on to the news. The first story I have is Google Desktop is now available for Linux. At the Linux Foundation Collaboration Summit, it was alluded to by a few Googlers that more Google Linux apps were coming very soon. Making good on that promise quickly, Google recently released the Google Desktop for Linux. Now, this is a native app, unlike Picasa, which was a Wine port, although it is not open source. It would be kind of interesting to see a side-by-side comparison of Google Desktop and Beagle, which I admit to not using at all, but I haven't seen that done yet. It is, however, good to see that, unlike in many cases with Linux ports, the Linux version here looks to be an exact feature match with both the Windows and the OS X versions. At this point, I think SketchUp and Notifier are probably the only two Google apps left without some kind of Linux version available, so kudos to Google for that. The next story I have is Top 500 Supercomputer OS Share. The Top 500 has released its latest supercomputer list, and Linux now represents over 75% of the Top 500. That means 389, or 77.8%, of the fastest supercomputers in the world run some Linux variant. And the caveat there is, should be noted, is that it's the fastest reported supercomputers. You would imagine that many governments across the world have computers should be on this list but just aren't reported. Moving back to the numbers, that's up from 65.2% in November of 2006, which was the last report. Windows made what I believe is the first appearance on the list, but according to an article linked from there, that machine has been rebooted as a Linux cluster as of this time. If you're interested in the full stats, head over to top500.org. The next story I have is a Red Hat CEO says he talked patents with Microsoft. And I think it comes as absolutely no surprise that Microsoft did in fact approach Red Hat before any other Linux vendor, including Novell, about the patent agreement that they ended up signing with Novell. Also as no surprise, or at least it should be no surprise, a discussion did take place and no agreement was reached. What was a bit of a surprise to me comes from an eWeek article. This is from that article. Quote, "The developer of Linux software has yet to sign such a deal, which could see Novell, its biggest rival, woo customers away from Red Hat and work on product development and sales with the world's number one software maker. In an interview with Reuters, Zulik declined to say whether his company is now in negotiations with Microsoft over signing such a patent agreement. I can't answer the question," he said. End quote. Now, when recently asked a similar question, Mark Shuttleworth gave an emphatic no, and this is from his response. Quote, "For the record, let me state my position, and I think this is also roughly the position of Canonical and the Ubuntu Community Council, though I haven't caucused with the CC on this specifically. We have declined to discuss any agreement with Microsoft under the threat of unspecified patent infringements. Allegations of infringement of unspecified patents carry no weight whatsoever. We don't think that they have any legal merit, and they are of no incentive for us to work with Microsoft on any of the wonderful things that we could do together. A promise by Microsoft not to sue for infringement of unspecified patents has no value at all and is not worth paying for. It does not protect users from the real risk of a patent suit from a pure IP holder. Microsoft itself is regularly found to violate such patents and regularly settle such suits. People who pay protection money for that promise are likely living in a false sense of security." End quote. Red Hat has also given a more deliberate type no answer in the past, so the change of attitude to the no comment variety could be a bit worrying. And here's hoping it's just due to corporate disclosure rules or something else innocuous and not an actual change of opinion. Of course, Red Hat signing a Novell-style infringement of unspecified patents type deal would be very bad. Now, to clarify on this a little bit, first let me say I absolutely don't think Red Hat is currently in discussion with Microsoft to sign a Novell-style patent deal, and note the emphasis on Novell-style. They may very well be in some kind of discussion, but that is not necessarily a bad thing at all. Remember, if Microsoft privately went to Red Hat with potential patent infringements, even silly unspecified ones, then Red Hat would be obligated to address that issue. That, of course, would require discussion. And it's very tough to be the CEO of a public company these days. No comment is very often the only answer you can give without the mainstream media twisting your words in all kinds of directions. Also note that Red Hat may be in talks about specific invalid patents or talks about something completely non-patent related but with Microsoft. And as Mark Shuttleworth pointed out, there are some things, especially on the technical collaboration side, that it's in both parties' interests to discuss. So in the end, who knows? Speculation on this is really mostly useless. I do remain confident, though, that a Novell-esque deal will not come out of this. And another thing to keep in mind is that Red Hat is fundamentally an open source company. It's in their DNA, and it's also reflected in both their employees and their culture. Novell had one or two people, although key people, leave after they signed the deal. I think Red Hat, on the other hand, would see a mass exodus, and the C-level execs at Red Hat know this. And not only that, they get open source at a very fundamental level themselves. Following is the last official statement I could find from Red Hat on this topic, and in the end, I have no reason to believe that this sentiment has changed. Here is that statement. Quote, Red Hat has only recently been able to see some of the terms of the original Microsoft Novell deal due to the belated and redacted SEC filings that were made. Based on what we have seen, the deal is not interesting to us. Red Hat continues to believe that open source and the innovation it represents should not be subject to an unsubstantiated tax that lacks transparency. End quote. The next story I have is Ubuntu on two new Inspirons. In a move that would seem to back up initial indications that the Ubuntu Dell offerings were selling well, Dell has officially announced that it is adding two additional models to the lineup. And here is a text from that announcement. Quote, from an Ubuntu perspective, we're now offering Ubuntu 7.04 to customers in the United States on the Inspiron 1420N notebook and the Inspiron 530N desktop. Both are available for order now at www.dell.com/open. Since these are new systems, it usually takes us a bit of time to ramp production. Because of that, we expect to ship these new systems by the middle of next month. End quote. And additionally here, Dell has confirmed that it plans to extend the Ubuntu rollout to countries outside the United States, and that's actually currently the number one request on IdeaStorm. Dell also indicated that they are considering bringing Linux to their small business customers. So it's great to see that the Ubuntu offering is being well received, and this move could very well be paving the way to both additional large-scale OEM Linux plans outside of Dell, and eventually, hopefully, someday, even a simple Linux on any model type rollout, which is really the end goal here and would be fantastic. So once again, kudos to Dell for kind of getting this kicked off. The next story I have is Massachusetts may adopt OOXML. What say you? Andy continues his prodigious coverage of the Massachusetts OOXML ODF debate. This is from a recent post of his. Quote, the Massachusetts Information Technology Division, or the ITD, the state agency that effectively launched the voyage of ODF around the world in August of 2005, has released a new version of its Enterprise Technical Reference Model. And this new draft includes Microsoft's OOXML formats as an acceptable, quote-unquote, open format. The new draft was posted today, and the very brief comment period will end on July 20th. The header to the announcement at the ITD website reads as follows. A review draft of ETRM version 4.0 is available for review and comment from July 2nd through July 20th, 2007. Comments should be submitted to standards@state.ma.us. This major release of the ETRM updates content published in version 3.6, introduces the new management domain, enhances the ETRM's format for accessibility and usability, as well as provides additions and updates to existing language and technical specifications. For a detailed outline of major revisions made in this version, please consult the Major Revisions for ETRM Version 4 document. The announcement is not a surprise to me, as I've been following the progress of the ITD's internal reviews over the past 6 months. I've not been commenting on this publicly in order to try to give Bethan Papali, once again the interim CTO since the departure of Luis Gutierrez, and her team the space to do their internal evaluations with less pressure than Peter Quinn experienced the first time around. However, and as you can imagine, the ITD has been under as much pressure behind the scenes, and perhaps more, as the legislators of those states that have tried and failed to pass laws that would mandate open formats in government. The OOXML-related changes to the text of the ETRM are deceptively insignificant. By my word search, there are only three references: the inclusion of the name of the standard in the introductory summary of changes, a brief description and migration section in the domain information part of the draft, scroll down and look for open format section, and the listing of ECMA along the other standards bodies on the list of relevant standards organizations. But the potential impact of these changes, if retained, will be great. How much pressure has the Massachusetts IDT been under to accept ECMA 376? I've been told by those in the know that the contacts reached all the way to Deval Patrick, our new governor. Here, as in the states where legislation was introduced, the point was forcefully and repeatedly made that Microsoft is the kind of company that can provide jobs and other economic support where and as it pleases. And, to be fair, the same points have been made in the past by representatives of IBM and Sun when they have spoke out in favor of ODF. Now, we are looking at a very short comment period, commenced with no advanced warning, spanning a holiday, and contained within one of the busiest vacation months of the year. One can't help wondering why. End quote. That makes the comment period less than 14 business days in a month that, as Andy points out, is one that is very popular for vacationing. Assuming the addition of ECMA 376 moves forward, the question becomes, how large of a blow is this to ODF? Opinions on this from reading around just remain all over the map. Some seem to think that it's just a minor setback, while others say it could potentially relegate ODF to being a footnote, pretty much. The fact remains that OOXML still only has a single implementation. It's also unclear if the latest version of Office completely implements the spec or implements items not in the spec. This means that if ODF adoption doesn't gain any traction, Microsoft will easily be able to move forward with proprietary extensions, let ECMA 376 completely languish, or even drop support in the future altogether. In other words, we'll be right back where we started. And that is quite obviously, I hope, a bad thing. Andy has further coverage on the topic, including reactions from around the industry, so as always, check out his blog. And a quick update that was posted just a couple of days ago by Andy on this topic. As he points out, silence means consent. If this is a topic that is important to you, and it should be, I'd encourage you to take a few minutes to make your opinion known. And here's a reminder from Andy's blog. Quote, a few days ago, I posted my comments to the Massachusetts ITD on whether or not it should include OOXML in its list of approved standards. I also urged anyone with an opinion on this issue to send their own comments to the ITD at this address, standards@state.ma.us. Now, Pamela Jones, who has contributed hugely to the ODF effort in the past, has just posted a long and informative entry at Groklaw, pointing her readers to various resources that they may wish to consult in preparing their own comments, as well as ideas on the various areas upon which comments may be relevant. PJ has done her usual great job on this, and I'd encourage you to read her entry to see how her observations strike you. It's particularly important for you to consider doing so, because I learned from a reporter today that only about 50 comments have been filed with the ITD so far. With only 8 days to comment left, This compares very poorly to the over 150 comments that were received by the ITD in 2005. I have no idea what percentage of these comments are pro-OOXML and what percentage urge the ITD to stick only with ODF, but given the small number in total, it could easily be disproportionate in one direction or the other, especially if a concerted effort has been made by one constituency or the other to influence the outcome. Regular readers will know that I think this is an important issue. Right now, the default decision in the ITD's new version of the Enterprise Technical Reference Model is to include OOXML. In my last post, I paraphrased one slogan from the activist 1960s that helped to shape a lot of who I am today. I'd like to now offer another catchphrase from those braver and more involved times, this time a chant from the many protest rallies that punctuated the anti-war movement. Silence means consent. That slogan is particularly apt now because the fewer the comments the ITD receives, the more certain will be the result. After all, if people no longer care, why should the ITD stick its neck out? The past immediate experiences of both Peter Quinn and Louis Gutierrez have made the consequences all too obvious. These people aren't paid combat pay to be controversial. They're just supposed to keep the IT structure effective for our benefit. If we want them to do more than just do what they're told by vendors, we owe it to them to back them up. End quote. I couldn't agree more. The last story I have is OpenMoco. While the iPhone has been getting all of the press in the mobile space lately, something seriously interesting has been happening in the open source mobile space. OpenMoco devices are now becoming available, and this is from a recent Wired blog post. Quote, after seemingly endless delays, the OpenMoco phone is here. The first version of the Neo 1973 mobile phone, which carries the Linux kernel inside and is not locked to a specific network, is available for purchase from OpenMoco.com. It's not as jaw-droppingly pretty as the iPhone, but it shares a design philosophy. No buttons, just a screen, and it's ready to be loaded with any number of open-source software applications. The base version of the Neo sells for $300. It has a 2.8-inch VGA touchscreen, a microSD card slot, a USB port, and 2.5G GSM quad-band capabilities. Keep in mind that this unit, the GTA 01, was pushed out early so developers could begin writing device drivers, custom GUIs, and some cool apps for the phone. The next revision, the GTA 02, which will be available starting at $450 in October, will be ready for the mass market. It will have Wi-Fi, 3D motion sensors, and added graphics accelerators. So if this phone isn't exactly an iPhone killer, the next one will be a contender. End quote. I think I'm going to try to hold out for the GTA 02, but we'll see if I make it. Either way, I'm definitely going to get one of these phones. That's the bottom line. Now, I'd probably keep the iPhone 2, even if just as a Wi-Fi enabled iPod. Which phone I'd use on a day-to-day basis kind of remains to be seen. But the more I use the iPhone, the more its closed architecture is definitely a limiting factor for me. Now, there are some rumors around of a pending firmware upgrade that, if it does prove true, could give more file system access and real third-party apps. Things could change then, but in that case, I may just carry around two phones. If you are interested in the GTA 01, I will recommend you go to the OpenMoco.com and check it out. This is definitely something we should support. That's all I have for now, but thanks for listening.